Writers have to look at what's best in human nature and what's worst. And this was my lesson at age 10 of the worst. My surprise is I never wrote about it until now.
Every raindrop reflecting on the water as the sun shuts her eyes. Don't know what you'll uncover. Watch the time rolling with the moonlight. Everything is silent on this Louisiana night.
You're listening to Missing Magnolias, and here with us to discuss her latest book, Deer Creek Drive, A Reckoning of Memory and Murder in the Mississippi Delta, is Beverly Lowry. Beverly is the author of 6 novels and 5 works of nonfiction. She has received multiple awards from the Texas Institute of Letters and the Mississippi Institute of Arts and Letters, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the Guggenheim Foundation. She is a native of the Mississippi Delta, but is Austin-based these days. Welcome, Beverly. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed your book, and I'm looking forward to going back now and reading some of your other books that Michelle and I had talked about pre-show. You've written biographies on Harriet Tubman, Madam C.J. Walker, and you are no stranger to writing about crime.
No.
You wrote about the yogurt shop murders in your now hometown in Austin a few years ago.
Actually, my first foray into writing factually about crime was Crossed Over, which was published in 1992, and that was about a Houston double murder. It was a combination memoir and murder story.
That's so interesting you've returned to that, is because this book is both a crime and your own personal memoir. Can you just lay the groundwork and tell us about this crime and how and why, because you were 10 years old around the time that the crime occurred, and many years later, you've decided to revisit both, really.
Yes. I grew up in Greenville, Mississippi, which was then called Queen City of the Delta. When I was 10, a murder occurred in the town next to mine, Leland, which is a tiny town that's on the heels of Greenville. A woman was horribly, brutally mutilated and killed in her home. The woman killed was a society matron. And the only person in the house at the time was her daughter. The dead woman was 67 and her daughter was 43. This shocked everybody in that region. Even as a young girl, I knew about it. My parents talked about it. And we were all shocked that such a thing would happen. Anybody who knows about this murder, who has heard stories of it, even if they weren't alive in 1948 when it occurred, is haunted by it since 1992. I wrote, as you said, 2 other books about really terrible, horrible murders. But all the time, I was thinking about this one. This was the one that affected me closest and was a part, I feel, what turned out to be my kind of sensory education as a writer. Writers have to look at what's best in human nature and what's worst. And this was my lesson at age 10 of the worst. My surprise is I never wrote about it until now.
Wow, that's so interesting how this impacted you. The book is about this horrible crime, but it's about so many other things. It's about class and race. Do you think part of that going back was trying to reconcile your own experiences? You touch upon so many interesting intersections of history in Mississippi at this time.
There's a lot about the history of the state, including the time I lived in, which I lived there, that is shameful and is hard to come to terms with, that I believe haunts us. So when we go back, there's this history. If anybody's going to write about the Mississippi Delta, they'd be writing about race and class. When I got into the details of the case, I realized how much could be gleaned from just that, from the details of the class, how people were treated, what people said, how the jury reacted when the thing went on trial. It was everywhere.
my head's being pulled in so many directions. I have so many things I want to ask you, especially about the research and just asking what it was like to re-interview people that possibly remember the crime or grew up with the crime. Can we go back a little bit? So who was Ruth and Idella in the community? And there's kind of a stark contrast with their upbringing with your own in the book. Can you speak to that a little bit?
The woman who was murdered was named Idella Thompson. And her daughter, who was in the house when the call was made that Idella had been murdered, was Idella's daughter, Ruth Thompson Dickens. She was married and lived only a couple of doors from her mother. She, too, grew up and lived on Deer Creek Drive. When Ruth Dickens called a doctor to come to the house, this was a doctor she knew very well. She and the sheriff were old pals. It was a typical small town situation. And Mrs. Thompson lay on the bathroom floor in her own house. She had been slashed, hacked with pruning shears 150 times. And the only person in the house was her daughter, Ruth, who was covered in blood. She said, unsurprisingly, that a black man, an intruder she didn't know, done it. That's the broad outline of the discovery. When the doctor showed, and then the sheriff, and then the police, this society matron lay on the bathroom floor for a number of hours, cut to pieces.
That would be shocking for today's standards.
Yeah, it's shocking, period.
And pruning shears, they're small blades.
As a girl, in my imagination, it was hedge clippers. In truth, they were pruning shears, which you can hold in one hand. The blades of pruning shears are curved like a hawk's beak. A friend of mine who's a gardener said, no wonder she was hit so many times because the cut would be much less deep even than blades of the same size if they were straight. One of the members of the coroner's team said she was pecked to death. I think that's probably true.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I mean, based on just what me and Scarlett were talking about, I was basically saying that takes a lot of dedication. When we talk about a crime of passion and stabbing somebody to death, we think about this frenzied movement in action with a whole lot of force behind it. But when you're murdering with somebody with some pruning shears, I have to think that takes a little bit more time. Because
it's a lot of open.
Yeah.
I think what's obvious is rage. You don't just come in and see if you can steal some money or some jewelry and stand there that long to stab somebody that many times.
It really doesn't fit the pattern of a stranger coming in and going past the knife. And she was a gardener, so that made it even more insidious. She really loved gardening. Yeah.
Ruth Dickens was said to be brilliant. She planted flowers that were natural to the area, which wasn't done back then. She had a real knack for planting things that other people considered beneath them or not appropriate.
So tiny woman, mother, daughter, likes to garden, does Sunday school teaching and maybe murdered her mother. And the pruning shears were wiped down and her clothes were washed, I believe you detailed in the book as well.
Yeah, so Ruth kept on the bloody clothes she had on, and she had injuries. She had injuries to her hands and some to her shins. When she went home to change clothes before she went to the clinic to get her wounds seen to, her cleaning lady maid took the bloody clothes and soaked them in a tub with soapy water. Of course, the sheriff should have kept the clothes as possible evidence. And they went back to get the clothes the next day, and they were soaked clean. Sheriff Hughie Foote had been in office only since January, and this happened in November. He wasn't trained in collecting evidence. You can say what you want about botched crime scenes, and all of them are botched to some degree, I guarantee you.
Yeah, and this was 1948, and you detailed so well that some of the people involved that came to the crime scene had family connections, so this would have been just super traumatic, and everyone knew each other.
Yeah, called each other by first name, and when the cops came, the investigators, the sheriff, and the chief of police came to interview Ruth. And you have to understand, she was not a suspect at this point. She was all the second victim. And as the sheriff said on the stand, Ms. Dickens said it was a Negro. They believed her. Nobody followed up any answers she gave that were questionable. Nobody questioned her about the details of the murder except to ask her to tell her story, which was this black intruder.
There's not a lot of evidence really tying her to the crime. And eventually it seems kind of likely that there was no intruder and stranger, and yet she's tried and sentenced for this crime. Can you talk a little bit about that and her sentence?
Well, there wasn't a lot of evidence, period, but any evidence that was there, including some buttons off Ms. Dickens' blouse and the blood on her, the washed shears, and a bloody handkerchief that had been left behind, all pointed to her. There were no good fingerprints, but there was nothing, not a shred, indicating that a man had been in that house. Nothing indicated that a black man had been in that house. The only evidence there was pointed to Ruth.
Darkcast Network. Indie pods with a dark side.
And then it's so interesting. Maybe you agree there's some sympathy with Ruth, even though she's committed these horrible acts and there's this level of white privilege that she is given. The media paid so much attention to her dress, what she wore, her mannerisms, which we discussed on other shows in relation to females in crime. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I did a lot of research on newspapers.com. Which is invaluable, because what you get there is not just what happened, but what the newspaper thinks people want to read. And so there would be a story about Miss Thompson's murder, about Ruth Dickens' trial, and then there would be some other splashy thing that had happened, maybe in Nebraska, you know, didn't have to be local. That would be another woman. And her dress would be described and her hairdo. It just always happened. It was a way of defining the woman by the way she dressed. And Ruth was a particularly rich source because she refused to dress in the ladies' fashions of the time. She dressed in what one newspaper called a golf dress. And she wore clunky shoes. It was always pointed out, no hat, no gloves, and no jewelry except for a watch. Plus, her hairdo was, and this story was written up all over the country, from the New York Post to San Diego Bee and all kinds of newspapers all over. The hairdo was called a mannish bob. The implications of that are obvious. And it was quite a swoopy Elvis Presley, Ricky Nelson haircut over the ears, no earrings. And it was unusual. It was unusual. And it was, I have to say, in your face. So she was seen as different, as rebellious. And she didn't go along with what other women did or what men thought women should dress. I do point out in the book, I was fascinated to study a little bit of the Lizzie Borden case and the trial because she hacked her father and stepmother to death. She dressed like a proper lady. She knew what to do, and she did it. And she set up, and she was described in all the papers as looking like she just stepped out of a Paris salon. She was a lady, and I think she got off because a lady would not do such a thing. And Ruth didn't do that. I know a lot of lawyers because I've covered a lot of criminal trials, and generally they see to it that their clients dress properly for the courtroom and especially for the jury.
Absolutely. I'm tickled by this conversation because I study media and crime. I do research on media and crime. Mm-hmm. And people always talk to me, well, like, okay, like, why do we frame victimization against women as a cautionary tale, for example? And it's like, because it's always been profitable. Like, we're trying to talk about something today in 2022, and we've been doing this same thing since the 40s and before that. And before we started writing things down, we've been villainizing women who do bad things in this certain way, focusing on their hairstyles or their physical appearances. We did the same thing with Eileen Wuornos. We personified her as this bad woman because she was so manly. And of course she did these terribly violent things because of her manly characteristics. Mm-hmm. We always have to throw that in there somewhere. It doesn't make sense to us that we could have women that look like the average typical woman and still do these bad, air quote, bad things. Like, oh my gosh, how dare they? We should be able to point these women out.
Of course. But first of all, they're women. They dress like that, they're suspect. And Ruth's androgynous look was not spelled out, but it was obvious that that's what the people were referring to.
Have you thought about possible motives? Because as we mentioned, this crime seems just pure rage.
You know what? I have thought about it endlessly. And I think what the prosecution came up with, these money deals, may lead to or maybe background to why Ruth flew into the kind of red rage that it would take to commit that particular murder. I think that Mrs. Thompson, Ruth's mother, had to have said something to inflame her. And if it was partially the money, and if it was partially had to do with the fact that Ruth had a preference to go out with and socialize with young women, young school teachers, high school teachers, especially one. And it's mentioned time and again. And the only reason Ruth's sexual preference applied to this crime is if it caused her to become so inflamed at her mother that she lashed out at her. And we don't know what Ms. Thompson said. And Ruth never said anything about any of that. There's also the matter of after Ruth's father died, Ruth and her brother took over the plantation they owned and tried to run it and failed miserably. And the property ended up in Ruth's husband's name. And that Ms. Thompson insulted Ruth about that, and perhaps also about this young woman.
Yeah, and it definitely paints a very complex kind of 3D view of this boogeyman.
Oh, yeah. One thing to keep in mind about Ruth, she was complicated, and a lot of people since then have said she was mean. They were scared of her before this murder, and so she could be bossy and she could be abrupt. She also had a great sense of humor. You don't think that about the boogeyman, right?
There's that scene when Ruth is in prison, and it's so telling of what her life might have been like while she was incarcerated, where she sees another college student and they have this moment or an exchange about she sees the sorority pin and mm-hmm. she just tries to engage in. You could probably tell it better, but it's so interesting because you either have this instance of someone trying to connect with the outside world, which is sad, or maybe there's a level of manipulation or just calculating. I'm not sure which I led to believe there, but it was very interesting.
I take it as in between. I think she full well knew that she was not a member of the same sorority as the college student. I was told this by a young man whose grandmother had been on a sociology tour to the state prison, the penitentiary. And one of the stories she told was meeting Ruth Dickens. And it was always scary. She had a very deep voice. It was a scary look to a lot of people. To see her didn't cause you to change your mind. She said, "Oh, you're a Tri-Delt," Ruth said to the girl. because she was wearing her Delta 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 sorority pin. And Ruth said, I'm a Tri-Delta too, as reported by the grandmother. I choose to believe her. And the grandson certainly did. And to see it as a part of Ruth, that she was able to use the situation, I guess you could call it manipulation.
So she served 6 years, and then multiple governors had come through, and she is released on probation?
No. It was more than probation. She was given, first by one governor, an indefinite suspension. It was only short of a pardon, in that if she killed somebody else or if she even did something that was a violation, she could go back to prison. And she didn't have the vote. Her suffrage rights had been taken away. She got out after about a little less than 6 years, including county jail time. She had been out, went back to teaching Sunday school. Ruth's husband was not satisfied, and probably she wasn't either, but he wrote the letter to not the next governor, but the next, saying he longed for a pardon for his wife. And she got a pardon, and that meant she could vote. And that meant she could never go back to prison for anything connected to this crime. Neither governor spoke of exoneration, and they did not say they were giving her these because they believed in her innocence. One said that he believed she had rehabilitated herself, and the other said it should have been manslaughter, not first-degree murder, which was what she was convicted of. So she got out. It was white privilege and power that got her out.
I can't imagine how that reverberated through the town. How did she go about her business? And I can't imagine what the aftermath, trying to read somebody.
I talked to a man who was a TV cable guy. He, like a lot of people, said he didn't want to talk about it. And I said, well, that's fine, because I got that answer a lot. There were people who were protective of the family, who were protective of their town, protective of the daughters and their children. Some reasons I never could quite fathom about. I mean, one man said, I can't believe they still think 70 years ago was yesterday. But anyway, this young man said he didn't want to talk about it. And I said, that's fine, but can you tell me why? Well, he said, I was scared of her. And he was supposed to go over there and lay some cable for their television set. And he said, I didn't want to go to her house by myself because he was scared of her. So her reputation rolled forward to some people. Other people said she's done her time. Basically, she gave parties and went to her daughter's wedding and was a member of the community again.
Wow. Such a story. I'm wondering, have you optioned movie rights?
Not at this point. You never know.
What's next?
Well, I'm fiddling around the edges of something. There's a lot I left out. As you said, there's a good bit of personal stuff in there because I was certainly not of the same class as Miss Thompson or Miss Dickens. And as I said, I started with the murder and moved out. The chronology of the book became from the Jim Crow South, which was when the murder occurred, through and beyond the Brown versus the Board of Education decision, integrating the schools in Mississippi. So I included originally a lot about my growing up time there, and especially high school girlfriends who were so important to all of us, and I think still are, to young women. Most of that is out. Almost all of it is out. And so I wanted to write some more about those times.
This was such a treat. So I want to encourage people to buy your book. You don't have a website, correct?
I don't. I know. And everybody says I should. And I think, oh, yeah, I should. And then I don't do it.
They should buy your book, number one, on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, wherever they get your book. And please keep us updated. I can't wait to read some of your other books. This was just amazing. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Thank you.